Good evening. I'm aware of a number of different stories, fantasies, fairy tales kind of stories, science fiction stories, where there's some hero who is fighting some great evil in the world, some evil being, Darth Vader or someone. And in order to succeed at this, you know, life and death combat, the hero has to be very balanced and not give in to anger. Somehow stay balanced and not somehow be caught by fear or caught by anger and be able to stay basically at peace or equanimous. And if they kind of give in to their anger, or allow themselves to get angry, then somehow they don't have the clarity or the presence of mind to fend off this evil being. And sometimes unfortunate things happen to our hero. So this is a balance of mind. And I know one story, which I now read 30 years ago, so I don't remember it so well. But Hermann Hesse has a book, The Glass Bead Game. And there's a character in the book who becomes kind of like a master, like a Zen master kind of person. And what I was most struck by in the book was the last page or two, the end of the book. And this master has become old. And he is standing at a kind of alpine lake together with a young man. And the young man jumps in to go swim across the lake. It's quite a cold lake. And at least in my memory, the way it struck me at the time, the master somehow, his pride or his something kicked in. This young man jumped into the cold lake and was going to swim across. He was going to do the same, keep up with him or something. And so he jumps in. Is that about right? Some of you read it, I remember. And so he jumps in and starts swimming across the lake. And I think he has something like a heart attack. As he doesn't make it, he basically drowns in the lake. That's the end of the story, so I remember it. And so here is a, you know, this great master who had this little moment where he got caught by maybe his arrogance or his pride or something, lost his balance, and lost his life. So all of these are pointing to a quality in Buddhism which is considered very important, and that is the quality of equanimity, equipoise, the balance of mind. A mind that doesn't give in to what's called sometimes the eight worldly winds, the pairs, four pairs, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, and success and failure. I think that's, is that right? All right, you get the idea. So a mind that doesn't give in to those. The world produces all these winds, and the mind can blow along with it, or there can be a strength of mind and a balance of mind, so the mind is not blown around by things. One of the things that it often blown around by is pleasure and pain. And the pursuit of pleasure, the pursuit of comfort, can, you know, in a cell, and it can be okay, but it's very interesting to watch what happens in the mind. And how the mind sometimes will lose its balance, will get caught up, wound up in the pursuit of pleasure. Sometimes it takes extreme forms of addiction. Or the pursuit to avoid what's uncomfortable or unpleasant. And it can be very subtle, but very fundamental to many people's psyche, the movement away from things that are uncomfortable, and to avoid, to deny, to turn away, to lash out, to get angry at, all as a reaction to what's unpleasant or uncomfortable or painful. And so the mind is somehow affected by it, gets pulled into the world of reactivity. Fame, being praise and blame is a great one for people where the mind gets caught. Someone comes and praises you and you can see the caughtness by the great energy gets born in you. That's good. And or some people don't like fame, and the opposite happens. Or blame, you know, that you'll wake up if you get blamed really well. You know, if you're falling asleep in meditation, just, you know, ask the person next to you to blame you for something or criticize you. The way you're sitting, you shouldn't be allowed in here. It's just terrible. Boy, then you'll wake up. All this energy, the mind gets caught so easily. Equanimity is considered to be, has a status in Buddhism where it's almost like a pinnacle, the top of spiritual development. It's a very highly appraised, highly honored mental quality. And you find in a number of lists, these famous lists that the Buddha had, that equanimity is last in the list, and being last is considered to be the most important. It's one of the seven factors of awakening, the seven qualities that directly come into play as a person gets liberated. It's one of the four forms of love, the Brahma Viharas, the Buddha championed. And it's the last one, equanimity, which is strange. People don't often think of it as a kind of love, but it's a kind of love. And then it's also the last of the 10 paramis, 10 perfections. And that's the topic for today, is to talk about the 10 perfections, or this 10th perfection. Because over the last year, approximately once a month, on Monday nights, I've been giving a talk on each of the 10 perfections. And I tried to do it close to the day where I did the Dharma practice day on that quality. And the last, I did equanimity in August. And somehow I was gone, things happened, and so now almost a month late. And I know you're very equanimously been waiting. So today's the last day in the talking about this, the tenth of the 10 paramis, perfections. It's the pinnacle of the perfections. And so if you had any idea that equanimity is kind of a uninteresting emotional state or mental state, it's kind of a dull one, that it's somehow, you know, kind of diminishes your life in some way. It's kind of not exciting or passionate, you know, you really want to get in there and, you know, live. The idea that it's the tenth of all these very important qualities, it's the pinnacle of it all, it gives you one idea that I don't think Buddhist puts it as kind of a dull, uninteresting thing. It's actually a very dynamic quality. To give you a sense of that dynamism or the dynamic quality of it, here's a description of the mind of equanimity. When the mind is fully imbued in equanimity, it becomes pure and bright, pliant, malleable, and luminous. Just as if a skilled goldsmith were to prepare a furnace, heat up a crucible, and taking gold with a pair of tongs, place it in the crucible. He would blow on it, sprinkle water on it, examine it, so that the gold would become refined, well refined, thoroughly refined, flawless, free from dross, pliant, malleable, and luminous. Then whatever sort of ornament he had in mind, it would serve his purpose. In the same way, there remains only equanimity, pure and bright, pliant, malleable, and luminous. So, this is not a dull state of mind. In fact, I think it's a very powerful emotional state, the state of equanimity. As the tenth of the perfection is kind of the end of the pinnacle of them. Now, the 10 perfections are qualities of character, qualities of the mind that can be developed as support, as aids to the Buddhist spiritual life, part of the development of it. There are many people who develop a spiritual life in Buddhism without reference to the 10 paramis, so they're not necessary. Often these qualities kind of come along with the spiritual life without knowing it, without intending it. It kind of follows in the wake of the mindfulness practice, for example. But some people actually like to train themselves and cultivate these qualities in themselves. And it's said that for people, it's one of the best practices or best ways of developing oneself if a person is living a lay life, living an urban life, living with family or jobs, or don't have a lot of chance to meditate a lot or be in retreat a lot and practice develop your meditation practice to some great degree. That a really important thing to do then instead or is to do develop these perfections. So these are to develop your character capacity for generosity. So it's not just simply, you know, as an idea of developing generosity, but develop a disposition. To the point that your disposition, your inner mental state becomes powerfully motivated by generosity. It becomes almost like second nature, perhaps. To cultivate a generous heart. And then the second parami is integrity or virtue. To develop your personal integrity so that you're not going to be very careful so you don't harm people. And so the most simplest way of talking about that is living by the precepts. And I'll tell you a great story I've told sometimes. Many years ago, I was teaching a class on Mahayana Buddhist Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, to a small group of kind of senior, mostly Zen students, Zen priests. But I invited in a classmate of mine from Stanford when I was studying there to be in the class. And she was doing Buddhist studies at Stanford. She was originally from Taiwan, Chinese, and had grown up as a Chinese Buddhist in Taiwan and a little bit in Thailand and then immigrated to America. And so she had a very different relationship to Buddhism than the other people in the class who were convert Buddhists. They were born and bred in America and had, you know, converted to Buddhism as adults, basically. This woman had grown up in her whole upbringing. She was deeply embedded in it. And she had left her degree, her law practice, in order to go back to Stanford and get a degree in Buddhist studies. This is what she wanted to make her life, was Buddhist practice. She had a Buddhist teacher. She was really committed to, to her Buddhism, making it central to her life. So I asked her one day, do you meditate? Because I wanted to know what kind of meditation she did. And all the people that I knew in the West who practiced Buddhism, they meditated. And that's the first thing they do. They jump in, they start right there. And she said, oh, not yet. I'm waiting until I'm worthy enough. Until I'm worthy enough. Now, she was a very ethical person, and to begin with, but she felt somehow that meditation was such a revered practice to do that it isn't something you just jump in cold, but something you prepare yourself to do. And so she was preparing herself by her studies, her ethics, her behavior, by developing herself in other ways. And then she was going to get to it. Well, I was so inspired by that. I thought she could have done both at the same time and they would have helped. But I was so inspired by that. I'm waiting to be worthy of it. So to cultivate an ethical life so that we're worthy, perhaps, or that more importantly, perhaps, that our inner ethical life, that foundation of our life which is ethical, is solid, stable, and unruffled. Because if you have an ethical strata of your mind which is ruffled or conflicted, it's very hard to go deep into Buddhist life, spiritual life. So to develop a character, a disposition towards integrity. Then the third one is renunciation, letting go, simplifying. And developing a capacity, an ability to let go when it's necessary to let go. And the whole question of when is it necessary to let go is a very interesting question to explore. And maybe people tend to not notice very well when it's necessary to let go. So to learn to let go, to have that capacity to somehow release the mind from what we're holding on to tight. You know, we hold on to grudges. And so develop the capacity to let go, maybe it's to let go of that, to the grudge. We hold on to our status. We hold on to many things that often cause a lot of suffering. So to develop a capacity to let go allows the mind to become simpler. And a mind that's simpler can do deeper work, can go further down. If it's complicated, the mind stays agitated. And then develop a capacity for wisdom. Wisdom often has the same meaning as discernment, developing a capacity to look in a discerning way, to be wise in how we understand our life, to be wise about when we should let go, for example. and then to develop capacity for effort or energy or perseverance. So kind of overcome laziness, inertia, but develop kind of a capacity to kind of, okay, I'm doing this. I'm getting up every day to meditate. I'm just going to do it, and not to have the inertia get in the way or any kind of way. Just to develop a capacity for applying oneself. And that's something that can be developed. And then developing a capacity for patience, a great one, especially if you're going to make effort. So you develop your capacity for effort, but then you follow right along with that, develop your capacity for patience so that the effort doesn't get frustrated when it doesn't succeed right away. And then, after that, is truth, to develop capacity for being truthful, living connected in harmony with what's true, with the truth that you feel, what you know is true. And then developing a capacity for resolve or determination. When you resolve something, when you know something's true and you resolve to do it, then have a capacity to get behind it. So it's a little bit different than perseverance or effort, but this is kind of a stick-to-ness. This is what I'm going to do. I said I'm going to do it. Okay, I'm going to do it. And so develop that character trait. So, you know, when we say we're going to do something, we follow through. And then developing a capacity for loving kindness, for being kind, being friendly, and not to leave our friendliness, our kindness, our love to chance, but actually look and see how can we develop it so that it becomes, again, something readily at hand that happens, you know, readily as maybe being grumpy or angry, irritated, happens now. And, you know, just kind of begin switching the balance. So develop a capacity for friendliness and kindness. And then finally, develop a capacity for equanimity. That's quite a daunting list to put them all together. So that's why we spent a year doing them. And some people said, who did the study class, said, a year was too fast. We should have done a year on each quality. But in daily life, there's a tremendous amount of opportunities to develop these 10 qualities. And so, in some situations, it's more patience. Some situations more were challenged in our ethics. I got a refund from the IRS today. And they sent me a bill this summer. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I didn't pay it right away because I was on vacation. I didn't pay it in time. They gave me they mailed it out on July 4th. Can you believe it? And then they wanted it back before I came back from vacation. So I got a second bill for the interest for having missed. So today I got my interest back. I looked at that and said, I wonder who made the mistake. What should I do now? What's the ethical thing to do here with my $8.11? So there's lots of opportunities, you know, coming along. And what do we do with our ethics? Do we just kind of blow it off, or do we think about it? Do we look at our ethical life? Are lots of opportunities for generosity, lots of opportunities for, you know, all of these. In different situations, different ones come to mind, and we can cultivate and develop it there. Now, the reason why this is important for people who are interested in meditation is that these 10 qualities are tremendously supportive or helpful for developing a deep, stable, penetrating meditation capacity. It's very lot easier to develop meditation when these things are there at hand. They become like powers. Now, the same thing can be said of equanimity. When the other 9 qualities have been developed, they become kind of like strengths that we carry with us. And when you have strength, it's a lot easier to hold your ground. It's a lot easier not to be pushed around by things. So if you develop a strength of love, of loving kindness, you're much less likely to be pushed around by different winds that the world provides. If you develop a capacity for resolve and determination, then you're much less likely to be pushed around because you know you're committed, you're going to hold your ground. If you have a capacity for patience, these become strengths we carry with us. So equanimity then is that capacity of not getting caught, not being pushed around by what happens, where the mind can stay balanced and peaceful. There are two kinds of equanimity. There's many kinds, actually. There's lists and lists of equanimity types. But I think there's two main types of equanimity. One is the equanimity that comes from a certain kind of, that can be called balance. When there's a kind of a capacity to be balanced in a strong way. So we kind of be able to reside at that place where we're not pushed back and forth. It's like having a tripod. If you have only two legs or one leg, it's kind of wobbly. But if you have three legs, it's stable. And so it's balanced. If you have nine legs, it's even more balanced. And so you develop some capacity to be well balanced on yourself. So for example, being grounded in your body, centered in your body, is a tremendous support to staying equanimous. You probably, if you're not in your body, chances are you can be caught. You're already caught, probably. But if you're not in your body, you're probably much less likely to be caught by the different things that go registered in the mind, reactive. So to be centered in your body is one of these strengths that provides greater equanimity. So developing calm, developing concentration, developing the other paramis, developing capacity for joy and happiness, all these are kind of strengths that can reside within us, and when they're strong, then we tend to be much more balanced. So the first kind of equanimity is equanimity of balance. The second kind of equanimity is the equanimity that comes from our understanding, how we see the situation, so from our wisdom. If someone calls you a dirty name, but then you already know that they have, what's the name of that syndrome? Tourette's syndrome? Is that what it's called? And they've been struggling with it for years. You know, they're heroic in how they've been struggling with it. They've done everything they can, and they do it to you one more time, but you know what it's taken that person, the toll on the person's life. And so you have this equanimity, maybe even compassion for that person, because you understand something about that person. So there's equanimity that comes from understanding. When someone does something that maybe even hurts us, some people have the ability to see that the act was stimulated by the suffering that other person was carrying in their hearts and in their being. You see, that person's really struggling in their life, and their unskillful behavior was really an attempt to deal with their own suffering. So some people have the capacity to see the suffering in others and then be more equanimous, not take it personally what they've said or what they've done, and have some compassion perhaps also. So they have equanimity through understanding. And so, now it's your turn. What are some understandings, some realistic understandings, that could help us see the world, see our relationship to others, or see ourselves with more equanimity, where the mind is not going to get caught, pushed off balance? What are some understandings? Can anybody offer some? Deeply. Smita. Maybe we can pass the mic to Smita there in the back.
Once you gave, I think, an example of Suzuki Roshi, where I might remember it wrong, but you said something like he pulled his glasses off one day and said, "These glasses are not mine." And that has made a very deep impression on me. And it seems to me, if we can sort of hold our belongings, our emotions, and our thoughts in the same way, "This is not mine." And even harder to look at other people's and say it's not theirs, that would be very easy to become and stay equanimous.
the thing I thought of was the realization that all beings experience suffering. So if you think of that, it helps you stay equanimous to things that come upon you.
Thank you.
If one can do, if one can reduce to the minimum the likes and the dislikes, that is one of the best way to get an equanimity. In spirituality we call this rag dvesh, which is probably the Sanskrit word for likes and dislikes.
Great, thank you.
Understanding of the fact that it will change.
Understanding that's going to change in permanence.
Permanence.
Like my, this too will change. When we're having difficulty at home, when my son was really young, my wife, with our young kid, my wife would look at me and say, "Oh, we're having one of those kinds of days." And that was a reminder, oh, this is only temporary. It's one of those days, and tomorrow will be a different day. There and back. Okay. Pass it up here.
When I feel attacked, I can't help but think that the attacker, in whatever sense, it may be a verbal abuse, a form of verbal abuse, maybe an act of terrorism, that the attacker has been attacked in some way, with equal force to what I feel, from what they, you know, and I can't help but think of experiences, everyday experiences with management in the workplace and also the big events on the news.
Great.
My suffering is just a reflection of the suffering of another person.
And connected to that also is that if I react in kind, then perhaps I'm perpetuating the cycles. And so one of the generous things to do in the world is to somehow or other end the chain that keeps being perpetuated.
I think of it in terms of like mental thoughts or representations in the mind of thinking one knows something. And I think Jung made a statement about, the antithesis of a thesis is always as true as the thesis itself. So
there's two sides to a story, you mean? Kind of?
I think something really very basic, and that is that if somebody throws that negative energy towards you, it's not that you want to throw it back at them, but you don't want to absorb it, because somebody on the road, especially in congested areas, could have had a rotten day and throw their negative energy at you in some form, and all of a sudden you're grabbing onto it and you're reacting, or now you're going to share that negative energy with somebody else. So the best thing to do is just dissolve that negative energy and not let it take apart or hold in our lives.
So one understanding then for equanimity is the cost that it takes when we absorb things, when we react or pick things up. It has tremendous cost on us, and then we pass it on perhaps to others. And one of the teachings of the Buddha is that if you get angry with your enemy, you do your enemy a favor, because you're causing a harm to yourself that your enemy can't actually do. Because the pain of anger is something you have to make from the inside.
I think when somebody reacts at you, the way I feel is that it's an opportunity for me to practice not to react. So it's really a favor.
So to be really motivated to practice, to see, oh, this is a practice opportunity for the paramis, for patience, for equanimity. And here we go. This is going to be a tough one. But, you know, it's like the rodeo sometimes. And an understanding that the tradition feels is very important is not to take excessive responsibility for other people's happiness. And that's the kind of, some people get really caught by that. And to have some understanding that people are responsible for their own choices. And if they make choices which are not wise, it might not be what you want, but somehow they have to make, they're making their own choices. And so we can't, you know, take full responsibility. And for a lot of people, that's a great relief to realize that, because some people, that's their Achilles heel. I'm responsible for that person's well-being.
Reminded of a person I used to work with that was in a pretty stressful situation, and this was in that era where everyone had those shirts with little alligators on them, that little animal. Yeah, okay. Well, he had apparently, his wife had found him a bunch of little ducks of the same size, and so he would have shirts that had either one, two, three, four ducks on them, and say, well, this is a two-duck day. It's going to be a real hard day. I need to just let everything roll off my back like a duck. And I just love that, because he was turning it into something fun. Yeah, this is a two-duck day. And he could be reminded of it, because everyone would see it.
Great. I'll read from the Buddha. This one, I like this one because it, I always feel a little more equanimous after I read it. They find fault in one sitting silently. They find fault in one speaking much. They find fault in one speaking in moderation. No one in this world is not found at fault. There has been, there is, and there will. There has been, there is, and there will be no person who is only criticized or only praised. So now you've been told. So that should make you equanimous, shouldn't it? Here it comes. You know, this is the praise. No matter if you, you know, no matter if you speak a lot or little or nothing at all, someone's going to get you. As a solid mass of rock is not stirred by the wind, so a sage is not moved by praise and blame. As a deep lake is clear and undisturbed, so a sage becomes clear upon hearing the Dharma. Virtuous people always let go. They don't prattle about pleasures and desires. Touched by happiness and then by suffering, the sage shows no sign of being elated or depressed. So no signs of being elated or depressed. So to not... And one of the forms of balance and understanding that's very helpful for equanimous mind is if we have some understanding or some experience of inner well-being. And if we can begin with a foundation of a sense of inner well-being, then it's much easier to understand the cost of being caught, the cost of reacting in ways. Even being elated sometimes has a cost, which is exhausting. It has a cost which can actually lead to further suffering. So to have a sense of well-being, inner well-being, inner peace, where praise, blame, success, failure, pleasure, pain, somehow, it, you know, you're not going to grab onto it or react to it in such a way to erase away, to do away that inner well-being. I think of equanimity as a protector and a guardian for something that's really precious inside of us. So rather than something which is diminishes us or something that causes us to be you know, less human, I think it actually supports the beautiful qualities of being a human being to flourish inside of us, because we're not covering it over or losing it by the reactive qualities of the mind. One of the most important supports for equanimity is mindfulness, to develop our mindfulness and develop our capacity to see what's actually going on as it's going on. If you don't know, if you can notice things as they're actually happening, then our wisdom and understanding can come into place, and we can see our reactivity and know what to do about it. And one of the important ways that mindfulness works also is we can begin understanding the very things that stand in the way of our equanimity, the very ways in which we lose our equanimity, lose our balance. And then to be equanimous about that, but to study that, to understand that really well. Not to feel, oh, you know, I'm not a good Buddhist because I lost my equanimity, but rather say, because I'm a good Buddhist, I need to understand why I lost my equanimity. I need to understand what happened there. And the more that we can study and understand how our mind works, the more less likely we are not to be caught by the forces of the mind as they occur. So equanimity comes from understanding ourselves through and through, not by holding on to some kind of state, some kind of ideal, at the expense of ignoring who we really are. It's by knowing who we really are that equanimity is the easiest. So that's understanding the full range of who we are. And the last thing I'll say, that, which I said every time I've taught about the paramis, these 10 perfections are not generosity, virtue, and so forth in the ordinary sense. Equanimity in the ordinary sense. Equanimity only becomes a perfection, one of these paramis, when it's joined together with two things, when it's connected to two things. When it's connected to our compassionate concern for the welfare of others. And when it's connected to our concern for our own liberation and freedom. So the concerns go in both directions, for the well-being of others and the well-being of ourselves, compassionate concern for others, and concern for our own freedom. When somehow we understand the movement, the practice, the development of equanimity somehow is tied or supports our compassionate concern for others and supports our own movement to liberation, then equanimity becomes perfection, a parami. It can't be one or the other, it has to be both together. And with enough equanimity, with a mind that's completely balanced, the mind is not going to react to and from anything. And when the mind has that capacity not to react to or from anything whatsoever, has this deep sense of peace, doesn't pick anything up, doesn't push anything away, but is balanced and peace in the midst of everything, then mind can let go of itself. And when the mind lets go of itself, that's even better than when the self lets go of the self. Isn't that great? When the self lets go of itself, that's pretty good. But when the mind lets go of itself, that's the best. But the mind can't be ruffled. It has to be completely still in order for that to happen. So, I hope that those of you who've come to these 10 talks over a year found them helpful. And may you take them one at a time to cultivate in your life. Thank you.